Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. It's January 2022 and I'm Sophia Davis. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Marissa Kay and Dr. Jamin Upadhyay, researchers from the Upadhyay Lab at Boston Children's Hospital, talking about work that they've done in collaboration with McLean Hospital. And this work is about their new biobehavioral framework of how childhood maltreatment influences the development of chronic pain and psychiatric conditions, which is published online this month and will appear in our next issue. So thank you so much to both of you for coming to talk with me about your fascinating paper, which I really enjoyed reading. If we just start right from the beginning, so I know your paper's about how maltreatment affects, well, childhood maltreatment specifically, affects the development of pain and psychopathology. But one thing that occurred to me right at the top was, when you say maltreatment, what exactly is it that you mean by that?
Yes, so maltreatment falls under the umbrella of trauma, but it's more specific in that there's an offender or aggressor. So rather than being the victim of an unfortunate circumstance, such as a car accident or a natural disaster, with maltreatment, someone is personally and sometimes purposefully causing harm to another individual. So this can come in many forms. And the five types of maltreatment that we often talk about are emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional neglect, and physical neglect. Now, unfortunately, maltreatment is often perpetrated by parents or other caregivers who are meant to protect the child. In other situations, children may face bullying in school or around the neighborhood. And in the case study that we describe in our paper, the patient was physically abused by a sibling. Having a stable support system is an excellent way to build resilience in the face of adversity, but when the trauma is coming from within the family or the community, it gets more complicated, and simply getting necessary treatment to the child can be very difficult.
And I guess some of those different types that you're talking about would also speak to different ages. Like when you're talking about bullying, it's likely that that would be of a slightly higher age group than some of the others. And how pervasive is childhood maltreatment? I'm sure this is hugely variant according to place around the world, but can you just give us like a sense of how pervasive this actually is?
Yeah, so the prevalence is a difficult question to answer because childhood maltreatment is really hard to measure. There's a lot of underreporting for various reasons. So individuals may have suppressed traumatic memories from childhood. Parents might not want to disclose what's happened to their child for fear of judgment or punishment. And children themselves are not the most reliable narrators. What I will say, in short, is that the World Health Organization does report that over 1 billion children experience some form of violence each year. So for context, that's over half of the children in the world.
Right. And when you consider that that's underreporting, that's quite an astonishing figure. Can you give us a sense of the type of negative outcomes for children and also going into their adult life, both in terms of their mental health and physical health?
Yes, so the effects of childhood maltreatment are incredibly pervasive across the entire spectrum of health outcomes. So we see increased risk for psychiatric conditions such as PTSD, substance use disorders, personality disorders, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. There's also an increased risk for pain disorders such as migraine, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, and chronic low back pain. And beyond the scope of this paper, childhood maltreatment also contributes to vision problems, diabetes, hypertension, cancer, and stroke. And with all that being said, these lists are not exhaustive.
Right.
And it can also be difficult to separate mental and physical health. So many people think of pain as a physical health concern, but pain is also a mental health issue and can be further complicated by psychiatric disorders. There's also a cyclical phenomenon, which we talk about in our paper, where the presence of pain may worsen psychiatric symptoms and vice versa. So once that cycle is activated, it can be difficult to break, even with rigorous treatment strategies.
Right. And I think that's what is part of what's so interesting about your paper, that you're trying to look at this, like you said, that pain is not just a physical issue. It's quite complicated when you really get down into what's going on. And I think that's so interesting in your paper that you're trying to tease apart the mechanisms at work there. So could you say a little bit about the model in your paper of the neurobehavioral mechanisms that are at work? Could you give us kind of an overview of your ideas there?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So, you know, one thing to know is, and we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier podcast, is that childhood maltreatment impacts an individual, whether from a neurobiological or behavioral standpoint, in quite a varied way. And so there's a lot of variability across traumatized individuals. And what likely drives this heterogeneity are factors such as, you know, what developmental stage did certain types of trauma occur, its duration, the type of abuse or neglect, or the severity of the maltreatment. These factors can alter in a very fundamental way the neurochemistry, the structure, the function of various brain systems that regulate things such as how we perceive pleasure or pain, or how we detect threat, or how we process fear. And also, childhood maltreatment can alter how we do basic things such as perceive a simple somatosensory stimuli. So that the outcome from a clinical or behavioral standpoint can range from, you know, being hypersensitive or hyposensitive to a sensory stimuli, or being hyperreactive or completely numb to a stimuli or an event that's normally rewarding. And these are, of course, just a couple of examples, right? And one thing to kind of note and appreciate is that there's a lot of variability in terms of the negative impact childhood maltreatment can have. But what appears somewhat universally is that childhood maltreatment fundamentally changes a way an individual perceives stimuli or events, which in turn impacts whether and how an individual reacts or behaves in his or her environment. It's important to note that the abnormal perception of stimuli or events can occur, you know, proximal or during childhood itself, or proximal to childhood maltreatment. And so this is something that you mentioned earlier, but it can also have an impact on how the individual behaves or how the individual perceives during their adulthood stages of life. Maybe some of the effects of childhood maltreatment, they're a little bit dormant during childhood itself, but then who knows, maybe something might trigger certain behavior, right, certain kind of mentality in adulthood stages of life.
There's so much to unpack in that. So it's interesting that you note how different the kind of clinical presentation could be, like the actual way that someone appears to be behaving could be wildly different. But what you're looking at is trying to sort of hone in on a few particular mechanisms that are key underneath. And so you mentioned that someone might be hypo or hypersensitive. So that's as in oversensitive or undersensitive. Can you tell us a bit more about that in terms of fear processing and threat detection, and how it could go that someone might go one of the two routes?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So one thing that might be helpful to note right now is that while we talk about an over or under sensitivity to pain, or hyper or hyposensitivity to pain, the phenomena overall, it might extend to aversive stimuli or events in general, and that these aberrant pain responses that we talk about in our paper, they're just representative of a maladaptive overgeneralization or sensitization type process. Moreover, the circuitry or individual circuits of the brain that underpin threat detection and fear processing, they absolutely play a key role in abnormal pain responses. But keep in mind that there are a lot of systems working in concert, including those that are part of the threat detection and fear processing network, to bring about something such as an undersensitivity to pain. And so, again, there's threat detection and fear processing are, you know, require lots of different brain regions and networks, some of which reside in the cortex, others which are located deeper in the brain. But they all kind of work together to bring about a behavioral phenomenon. And there's, you know, behavior of certain regions such as the anterior insula, which is a deeper kind of cortical structure in the brain. And in some individuals, the anterior insula, it may react in a suppressed manner when a painful stimuli is present. And so the behavioral output of this is that maybe the patient who has undergone some type of childhood maltreatment or some type of trauma, they're hyposensitive to pain. And this kind of hyposensitivity to pain may link with other aspects of the person's phenotype, like depressive symptoms, emotional numbing, or dissociation. In other patients, right?
That would be an example of how what you were saying before about, Marisa, about how pain's not just a physical thing. So this yeah. kind of hyposensitivity, this numbing, that's an example of how it's both linked to pain and to what we might call psychiatric disorders.
Yeah, exactly. And to expand upon that a little bit, the anterior insula, if you look it up regarding its function, it's always about the involvement of this particular brain region in emotional processing or salience processing. It's not really about physical sensations at all. It's more of an emotional hub of the brain. And so this region, and I'm just using the anterior insula as an example, it can kind of go the other way, right, as well in another patient. So maybe the anterior insula might overreact to a pain stimuli. And so, you might have hypersensitivity, right? And so this type of hypersensitivity might link more with things such as anxiety or kind of more kind of gain of function type of symptoms.
Right. And physically that would then be a heightened sensitivity to pain right. also.
Right. And one thing that we kind of mentioned in the paper is that in some of these individuals who have experienced childhood maltreatment, there might be a loss of top-down regulation of pain or aversive stimuli. So when you have a situation where you have all this noxious, pain stimuli flooding the brain, but then you don't have kind of like this top-down control of that, bottom-up process, then, you kind of have a little bit of chaos. And that's maybe how this oversensitivity to pain kind of comes about.
It is interesting how it could go one of the two ways. How do you think the undersensitivity would come about?
I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to that question, yeah. but I think it goes back to what types of trauma the individual experienced, when they experienced right. it, the severity of that trauma, who did it. So I think all those types of factors play into what direction or what trajectory a patient right. takes. One of the things that we, found really fascinating is that there are some conditions like borderline personality disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder, where there's this paradoxical kind of pain perception that's active. So in some patients with PTSD, when you give them a pain stimuli, they have kind of like this initial hyposensitivity to pain, right? But then the longer that stimuli stays on, or if there's a chronic pain state that's present and active, something opposite happens in that they are hyperactive or hyperreactive to that longer durating pain stimuli. So, for some conditions, it can be really complex. You can have an initial hyposensitivity, but then a hyperreactivity to pain.
Interesting. So then shifting from the sort of threat, fear side of the mechanism, you also talk about another mechanism, which is reward and anti-reward systems. How is it that childhood maltreatment affects those systems, would you say, according to your model?
Sure. So childhood maltreatment can impact how a patient processes or perceives a reward or, again, an aversive stimuli or experience. in some cases, there might be an exaggerated response to a normally benign stimuli in one individual, and then in another individual who has unfortunately experienced childhood maltreatment, there can be a suppressed response to an aversive or noxious stimuli. It's also important to keep in mind that it's not just about the stimulus or the event, right? But there's also an importance placed on the context or the environment that the individual is in when a rewarding or even an aversive stimuli is present. So there might be certain qualities about or aspects about one's environment that may cause an individual to expect or anticipate certain things to happen. And that factor alone can dictate the behavioral response or outcome from a reward processing standpoint. From a neurobiological perspective, childhood maltreatment and perhaps trauma in general appears to modulate the behavior of key reward systems in the brain or key reward structures in the brain, such as the nucleus accumbens. And the nucleus accumbens is this deep, kind of small subcortical region in the brain that is implicated in things such as substance use disorder, pathological gambling, PTSD, and also chronic pain syndromes. And so that kind of tells us that there's quite a lot of links and associations between reward systems, mental health, and chronic pain. And there's actually so much overlap between these kind of different constructs or different domains that we could probably have a podcast on this topic alone, you know, where we talk about the associations. But at a very high level, what likely bridges reward and aversion processing and mental health disorders and chronic pain is that there's common structures or networks involved, such as a nucleus accumbens or common involvement of endogenous neurochemical substances such as opioids and dopamine. And it's because of this commonality that we see so much in terms of PTSD and chronic back pain comorbidity, or bipolar disorder and migraine comorbidity. It's likely this robust neurobiological overlap involving reward systems.
But it's interesting because when you're talking about rewarding or aversive stimuli, like I'm thinking at first of external things that are rewarding or aversive. But when we're talking then about someone's experience of chronic pain or acute pain, then we're talking about an internal stimuli. How is it that pain is being involved in the reward systems, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, some of the same regions that process reward also process aversion, right? So chronic pain can be thought of as like a long-term aversive stimuli.
If you think about it on a very basic level too, the relief of pain is quite rewarding. If you sprain your ankle and then you ice it, feels pretty nice. Mm-hmm. So even on that basic level, it's quite rewarding.
One thing that we want to mention is, there are, treatments out there such as buprenorphine, right? And what does buprenorphine do? It's a partial mu opioid agonist, right? That is used to treat opioid use disorder. Right, that's what's one of the first line treatments for opioid use disorder. But this same therapy, it has shown that it has the ability to mitigate pain. It has the ability to mitigate depressive symptoms and even suicidal ideation. And I'm just bringing this up because I think one of the reasons why buprenorphine, this opioid partial agonist, is able to do all this is because of how it acts on the reward system and the implication of the reward system across different types of mental health conditions.
It's almost like it just underlying your paper is that you need to focus on states of being that can include physical elements and what we might call mental health elements, but they're all part of a big tangle, it sounds like. So you talked right at the beginning a little bit about resilience. We mentioned resilience a bit, and I wanted to circle back to that. You know, a lot of work in trauma has shown that people have differing degrees of resilience to experiences that may or may not be traumatic for them. What does that look like on the level of the brain and these different systems that you've been studying?
So on the neurobiological level, we see resilience is associated with white matter pathways. So in the brain, gray matter is where a lot of the processing is done, and white matter is responsible for communication between different areas of the gray matter. So if you think of a neural signal as a landline phone call, the gray matter is analogous to the telephones. We speak into the mic, and the phone transmits the sound waves of our voice into electric signals, which are then transferred to another telephone through wires. So the white matter is like the wires. And if you damage the wire, the phones can't communicate with each other. So with resilient individuals, we see stronger white matter pathways, which may ultimately allow for more effective communication within the brain and somehow serve as a protective mechanism against the neurodevelopmental detriments of maltreatment.
I love that analogy. That's really great. How does that end up happening, that some people seem to have better wires, like more resilient white matter, like either in terms of the brain or in terms of life factors that might have led to that difference in the brain? How does that difference come about?
Yes, absolutely. So the developmental status of the brain during childhood renders it incredibly vulnerable to many of the negative effects that we've talked about. But this also lends itself to establishing resilience. Kids are incredibly resilient. And lifestyle factors such as sleep, exercise, mindfulness, all of these things can help reinforce the connections in the brain that we want and protect against or mitigate many of the maladaptive changes that we describe in our paper. But above all, the number one thing is social support. So as I mentioned earlier, whether it be a family member, a teacher, a coach, a neighbor, having someone to confide in can really help a child build resilience in the face of adversity.
And that's, like you were mentioning at the beginning, that's so important in terms of maltreatment, because often this, it's coming from someone in a close relationship to a child. So that if you compare it to other types of trauma, that makes it harder to obtain resilience from a social source.
Yes, exactly.
One thing that comes to mind is, you know, so Marisa and I, in our lab, we do some studies on patients with these horrendous rare bone conditions. And some of these individuals are impacted from infancy, right? And what's so interesting when I look at these individuals and when we interact with these individuals is that they have quite a bit of resilience. They have quite a bit of, it's inspirational almost to see how positive they are when they have every reason to be mad at the world or to have, you know, certain, you know, symptoms. And I'm sure, you know, they have certain symptoms, but they are pretty resilient. What we believe, what we hypothesize is that this resilience might be something that's inherent in that individual, but it also likely stems from the fact that they have very robust social support systems. They receive really great clinical care from top-notch physicians and hospitals. And so when you put all this together, it just kind of builds resilience in an individual that can, you know, be expressed during childhood, but also in adulthood stages of life.
And just thinking about your, like when you're talking about some people who you work with, it was making me think, like, this is probably a too big question, but what was it that led you to develop this model at all? Like, where was that coming out of from your work that you've been doing?
You know, it's just kind of one thing led to another. You know, we're doing studies right now involving patients with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder patients. And some patients with schizophrenia, they are hyporesponsive to pain or and other types of stimuli. And, you know, there are some other patients with, say, PTSD that they also have this hyporesponsiveness to pain. So, you know, we were just trying to think about, is there something that is fundamental across all of these conditions that's causing the pain and psychopathology? You know, and there's so much overlap, as we mentioned earlier, between the brain systems that regulate pain and psychopathology, that maybe there's some type of common denominator that can explain at least part of what we're seeing. So I think that maybe was kind of the initial, you know, place where this idea to develop this manuscript came from. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and, you know, we're pulling information from other people's work. And I think that's how it all came about.
That's really great to know how it came from actual observation and just wondering why is this like that?
Yeah. And if you look at our first paragraph from our paper from maybe January of 2020, you know, it looks very different from what what we eventually wound up writing, right? Just because as we're learning more about the topic, as we're, you know, kind of talking with our co-authors about different ways childhood maltreatment affects pain and psychopathology, that of course shaped the manuscript quite a bit as well.
And one of the things I liked about the manuscript is how you tried at the end to bring it home to like clinical relevance. Like, how could this, okay, great, we're trying to develop this model, but how can we then use this to try to improve or change clinical practice? Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So the early recognition of susceptibility for developing psychosis or psychiatric regression, it's sometimes difficult in childhood or adolescent populations. And so the outcome of any type of delayed detection of risk factors relevant to psychosis is just a lost opportunity for implementing early treatment interventions that can preserve function in the individual, or it, just as importantly and relatedly, instill resilience in the child, right? And so with that being said, some pediatric patients, they might present with somatic symptoms or pain before a clear psychotic symptom or before frank psychosis. And also, patients may express to a parent or guardian or a care provider that they feel pain or that they don't like being touched in certain parts of their body or being touched by others. Maybe that's just a little bit easier for a child to express. And so in this type of framework, in this type of scenario, if there aren't any objective findings on MRI or physical examination that can explain these physical symptoms, right, then that can early on let a physician know or a care provider know that, hey, maybe there's something else going on here that's more centrally, you know, driven, or that's psychological in nature, or that maybe some kind of psychiatric symptoms might be emerging. But keep in mind that, you know, there might very well be visual hallucinations and delusions happening in a child alongside these somatic symptoms or pain. But it's just that it's easier for the child to express that they're feeling something physical, right?
Right, I see.
Yeah, so that's the way we're looking at it.
So in a way, it's like you're trying to highlight that to different kinds of physicians and psychiatrists also, that when a child is expressing something somatic, that this could be used as an indicator or just something to make you suspicious about what else could be going on and if it could be an early sign of something more psychiatric.
And things such as, you know, pain and somatic symptoms in the context of psychosis in the childhood population, especially childhood maltreatment population, they're not necessarily investigated using, you know, kind of rigorous neurological or neurobiological techniques. And so perhaps by looking at somatic symptoms and pain in the context of childhood maltreatment, we'll just understand this condition from a slightly different perspective. And if we can see things from a slightly different perspective, this might give us some novel insights, whether it's from its underlying pathobiology or even from a clinical perspective. And I think this all will have implications from how to implement the best treatments for an individual patient or subtype of patient.
And one other thing, I suppose, is that, like, we're talking about childhood maltreatment this whole time, but, you know, childhood is a pretty large number of years. And you talk a little bit about that in the paper. Are you able to say a little bit about how much the age matters, or like what kinds of different things come out of different ages of a child actually experiencing maltreatment?
So different parts of the brain mature at different periods in development. So the timing of maltreatment can play a very important role in biological and behavioral outcomes. So for example, the hippocampus is a region of the brain that's especially important in memory, and it's most vulnerable between the ages of 3 to 5. Whereas the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for a host of functions, including emotional regulation, is most vulnerable during adolescence, with peak ages between 14 to 16. And a lot more research needs to be done in this area, but a general trend that we've seen is that basic bottom-up processing is more affected by maltreatment earlier in childhood, whereas more complex top-down regulation is affected more by maltreatment later in childhood. And a useful tool for further research in this area is the Maltreatment and Abuse Chronology of Exposure, or the MACE, which was developed in 2015 by Dr. Martin Teicher, who's a co-author on our paper. So a typical childhood screening question might be, did anyone make inappropriate sexual comments or suggestions to you? So the MACE will ask this in a yes or no format, but rather than lumping the whole childhood together, because as you said, childhood is a long time, the respondent is then prompted to indicate at what ages between 1 to 18 this experience occurred. So this is incredibly valuable to investigate the effects of different types and timing of maltreatment on various outcomes. And an example of this is we see a lot of cognitive deficits and psychotic disorders. And using the MACE, researchers have found that in patients with psychotic disorders, attention, memory, and learning are most affected by maltreatment around the age of 3, which likely corresponds to that vulnerability with structures such as the hippocampus. On the other hand, social cognition is most affected by maltreatment around the ages of 10 to 12, when more complex emotional pathways are developing in adolescence.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. I think that's covered all of the questions that I had from looking at the paper. Do you have any other things that you would like to say about it that we've missed off so far?
I think the one thing that, like, as we're developing this paper and when I kind of look back at the paper itself, is how diverse the outcomes of childhood maltreatment can be, right? And, you know, when we think about, at least what I did before writing this paper, like when we think about schizophrenia, or when we think about even basic things such as how someone reacts in a social situation, right? Or everyday situation as an adult. You know, sometimes like when you take these types of things into consideration and you see something that's maybe even like surprising or alarming. Now, because of this manuscript, I say, well, is this person reacting in this way because of something that happened to them in their childhood stages of life? You know, and I think sometimes it could be maltreatment, but sometimes it could just be something traumatic that's happened to them that maybe doesn't classify as, you know, maltreatment per se.
Yeah.
So again, this whole idea that what we experience as children, good or bad, really shapes, you know, how we interact and perceive the world as adults. It's a pretty durable effect.
Yeah. And our paper highlights that sort of cyclical pattern that we see with chronic pain and psychiatric illnesses, but just in general, maltreatment is such a big part of phenotypes across all different health outcomes. So it's super important to screen for that in children in any specialty and any division of medicine, because
right.
It can really tell you a lot.
At the beginning of, given what you were saying at the beginning about how widespread it is, it feels like then you should investigate how it would affect anything, because if it's there so much as the base, then.
And then I guess the last thing I'll add is, in the pain treatment world, so many different therapies fail, right? Because maybe we're thinking of, you know, developing novel analgesics, you know, with this kind of physical phenomena at work, right? And so you dampen what's happening in the periphery, and when you dampen what's happening in the periphery, then you're going to hopefully see an analgesic effect. But then when you take into consideration kind of affective components of pain, the, you know, impact that childhood maltreatment can have on affective pain processing, right? Then it kind of points to how difficult it is to treat pain in adults, especially in this context of, you know, when there was childhood maltreatment. In fact, it's probably not that surprising that a lot of pain treatments don't work for, you know, conditions such as chronic low back pain or migraine, what have you. It's because there is this, likely in some patients, big effect coming from things like maltreatment.
Yeah, I was really astounded by some of the figures that you had in the paper about the increased likelihood of various kinds of chronic pain or chronic conditions if someone had been maltreated as a child. It was just a little bit mind-blowing. Yeah, and I think that's, yeah, a really important part of your paper, sort of really trying to get home this message of not seeing these things as separate boxes. Okay, let's treat pain as physical and let's treat psychiatric things as mental, as if they were happening entirely separately from one another.
Yeah, it's one body, right?
Exactly. Or, yeah. And where are you going from here? Like you said that you've learned so much thinking about and developing this manuscript. Are you continuing to work with these ideas, or what's on the cards next, if you're allowed to say?
Yeah, well, we definitely have this one project that Marisa and I and our co-authors are working on, where we are looking at how patients with schizophrenia as well as bipolar disorder, how they respond to pain. This is an NIH-funded study that's been active for about, what, 2 years now, a year and a half?
Yeah, about.
So I think some really novel insights will come about from this work. Then we're also, you know, hoping to do sort of parallel studies in pediatric patients who experience psychosis. And so maybe we can then start to see if there's any kind of bridges between what we see in pediatric patients and adult patients from a pain perception perspective. So yeah, I think this manuscript that Marisa, you know, drove is going to be the source of a lot of great ideas coming from our lab, but hopefully other labs and other people who read this work, and hopefully just puts a good spotlight, a much needed spotlight, all the effects that childhood maltreatment can have on an individual.
Yeah, wow, you have your work cut out for you. But it sounds like very fascinating big projects. Thank you so much for telling me more about your paper, which I anyway enjoyed at the start, but now I feel like I understand it a little bit more deeply. So thank you for that.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, appreciate
your time. It was great to chat.
You can read Dr. K and Dr. Apadhyay's research online now at thelancet.com. Thank you very much to Dr. K and Dr. Apadhyay for talking with me, and thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health wherever you usually get your podcasts.